This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Joe Palca in Washington. And now, candy. The world of candy has changed since the days of independent confectioners creating regional delights. Gone are the days of Oompas, Bar None, Squirrel Nut Zippers, or the creamy Caravelle. Now corporations handle the candy craze. Today's candy lovers have more choices, but some of our favorite treats now exist only in memory. Do you remember a favorite candy bar from your childhood that one day disappeared? Do you constantly search it out? If so, you may be a candy freak. Give us a call. Actually, even if you're not a candy freak, even if you don't like the term freak, it's perfectly all right to give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. But Steve Almond does like the term freak. In fact, he's written a book about his candy obsession. It's called Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. And he joins us now from the studios of WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Steve Almond, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, okay, you say you've eaten at least one piece of candy every day of your life. Now, first of all, when do we start counting? And then second of all, what's your favorite candy?
Okay, well, I guess we would start counting at about age, probably 18 months,
okay,
which is where we have photographic evidence of the freakdom.
Yep.
And I would say the favorite candy bar, well, it no longer exists, like a lot of my favorite bars, was the Caravelle, which you mentioned in the intro. It's one of the bars like Marathon or Chocolite or Powerhouse, which suddenly disappeared from my world, and I was left bereft and terribly neurotic about it.
I'm torn between exploring your neuroses and asking you what a Caravelle bar was. I guess I'll start with a Caravelle bar. What was that?
Yeah, that's probably the better option for you. It was a delicious piece. It's similar to the $100,000 bar, now called the 100 grand bar, a very rich, fudgy caramel enrobed, that means covered, in milk chocolate with Rice Krispies, and it was about 100,000 times better than the 100,000 bar.
Wow. And who made that?
It was made by Peter Paul, and as has happened with the entire confectionery industry, consolidation has meant the disappearance of a lot of these brands. So, you know, Peter Paul was bought out and then bought out again, and that was one of the bars that was discontinued because it wasn't profitable enough for a bigger company.
Wow. But Peter Paul, I mean, okay, so who makes? I'm sorry, I've been programmed. I don't know if we're the same age, but Peter Paul is Almond Joy and Mounds in my mind.
Yes. Well, they also made No Jelly, another delicious bar that disappeared, and the Caravelle and several others. And when they were bought, yeah, that was a peanut butter bar, ergo the No Jelly.
Got it.
And when they were bought out by a larger company, not all the brands are as successful, so they're discontinued. You see the same thing today with some of the big three, Mars, Nestle's, and Hershey's, are tremendously profitable. They're huge multinational companies at this point, and when they have a brand that isn't really making enough money, it's not worth it for them to continue with it. Sometimes they introduce what are called brand extensions. So, for instance, Kit Kat, which is a delicious bar, everybody knows, wafers covered in milk chocolate. They've come out with new varieties, white chocolate and also a dark chocolate Kit Kat that is, by the way, sensational. I know because I have 14 cases in my house.
A dark chocolate Kit Kat, is that what we're talking about?
We're talking about a dark chocolate Kit Kat.
Okay.
Those brands, those are really brand extensions, and the big companies don't want those to compete with their most popular brand. It's called cannibalizing in the retail world. So they just introduce them for a limited time. And, you know, some people like me who are kind of nutty about this get very attached to particular brands. And when they disappear, we get, you know, quite bereft.
Okay, the candy fans have started checking in, and we have an email from Benjamin Powell who writes, "When I was a kid, I ate a candy bar PB Max all the time. When I was about 16, it disappeared. I still look for it every time I go to the store. I guess I still hold out hope." That's Ben from Minneapolis. Any sign of, what is it called, a PB Max?
No, the PB Max, this is just like the No Jelly or the Caravelle or the Powerhouse, these bars are really not profitable enough to reintroduce again, and it's virtually impossible at this point to compete against the big three. It's just impossible to try to compete for shelf space. You have to pay a rack fee in order to get into the big chains, and with consolidation, you know, the big guys push down the little guys. So unless Mars or Hershey's or Nestle, whoever owns the patent on the PB Max, which was a delicious peanut butter bar, actually, unless one of them wants to reintroduce a retro bar, probably he's out of luck.
Can you just explain what a rack fee is? Because I found that to be a fascinating concept.
So did I. I was totally unaware they exist. When you want to get a particular product into a desirable space in a store, especially in a big chain store like a Walmart or a Costco or Sam's Club, and you want, for candy, you want placement near the cash registers because obviously candy is an impulse buy. You don't go to the supermarket saying, let's see, eggs, butter, and Snickers bars. You know, there's something that people buy because, you know, on an impulse. They feel
people,
guilty.
Most
about.
People don't anyway. Yes, well, granted.
Right, I do. Right, I always put it, you know, yeah. My list says Snickers, Milky Way, Three Musketeers. But for most people, it's an impulse buy. So what you want is to be right up near the registers where people have to mill around. And when they're not looking at the National Enquirer, they're gazing at those beautiful candy wrappers and getting tempted to buy them. Well, the retailers know that it's very, very lucrative. Those spaces are really worth money. They're actually called real estate in the parlance of retail, and so they charge the manufacturers a rack fee or a slotting fee in order to have those desirable places in the store.
Interesting. Well, let's.
And the little guys, the little guys can't afford to pay that, unfortunately.
I see. Well, let's. I'm torn. I mean, I'm so shocked by this, but maybe a caller can rescue me. Tommy in Tallahassee, Florida. You're on the air. Welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Oh, good.
Yeah, I'm calling from Tallahassee, and I just wanted to comment, Marathon Bar used to be, like, the best bar in the world. It was one of those candy bars to where, you know, when I was a kid, I used to just love it, and it was, it used to have the commercial to it, too. It was like the guy used to dress like John Wayne, and he was, like, in one of those old saloons, and it was just a great candy bar. Then it just, like, disappeared, and it is just one of those things, you're just like, man, you... What happened to it? You know, it was like a foot. It was 12 inches. It actually had like the little ruler imprint on the back of the candy bar. Like the show was actually 12 inches long. It was great.
Tommy, thanks for the call. What about Marathon? Has that lost and gone forever, or does that still exist in some?
No, it's lost and gone forever, I'm sorry to say, and I'm happy to say that Tommy and I share that freak tendency. The Marathon Bar is one of the bars that everybody remembers because it was really just a rope of caramel covered with chocolate, so it wasn't that exciting as a bar, but the packaging was brilliant, and I've seen this over and over again as I talk to other candy freaks, you know, traveling across the country. They always say it was 12 inches long, and you could tell because they had a ruler on the back. It's such a great example of how nostalgia sort of distorts things. It wasn't that long, you know. It was actually, I don't know, 6 or 7 inches long, but that ruler made it seem so dignified. And this is what you find when people start talking about their favorite candy bars. It's such a nostalgia trigger because, you know, for kids, candy is the sex, drugs, and rock and roll of their existence. It's this forbidden pleasure. It's their first experience of economic empowerment. They inevitably remember the first place where they used to go buy candy. And it's also a great act of self-love. You know, to have a candy bar for a kid is really as close as you're going to get to nirvana. So people get very primally attached to their favorite candy bars. I too, was a huge fan of the Marathon Bar.
Speaking of which, let's go to Jeff in Oakland, California. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks. I just want to tell you about something new in the world rather than something that's disappeared.
Good.
There's this outfit in Berkeley, California that makes handmade chocolate candy, which is fantastic, delicious, wonderful stuff. It's called Scharfenberger, and I think it's placed mostly in the local market. It's not got national play yet, I don't think.
Actually, Scharfenberger is quite a well-known firm, and they do make delicious chocolates. But I have to say that they're gourmet chocolates. They're delicious. There's no question. They make wonderful, wonderful chocolate, and they've really made a big name for themselves. But you can find them. The thing is, you're going to have to pay a pretty high price for them. And the candy bars that I was really interested in for the book were candy bars that were like they used to be made in the old days, regional candy bars that were 65 cents or the equivalent of, that were the same cost as all the other bars out there. So I'm talking about candy bars like Idaho Spud out of Idaho, or the Twin Bing out of Sioux City, or the Vallow Milk out of Kansas City, or the Goo Goo Cluster, which is a southern bar. But these gourmet firms like Scharfenberger and Lake Champlain absolutely make delicious chocolates. It's just they cost about $2 a pop.
Jeff, thanks very much for the call. I'll pause here for a second to remind people that they're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Well, that's the distinction, of course, isn't it? The difference between, you know, the sort of pop them in your mouth quarter, well, I don't know, nickel candy bar. I guess that's a ridiculous expression, but something's cheap and easy versus something a little more refined.
That's exactly what they called them during the Depression. They were called nickel bars, and they were really, I really didn't realize this until I started researching for the book, they were the first form of fast food in this country. During the Depression, you would have candy bars like Chicken Dinner, which actually had a steaming chicken on the label, and the idea was to convince people who wanted quick energy and wanted it inexpensively that if you ate this candy bar, it would be as nutritious as a chicken dinner. It was really our first fast food.
There you go. We have an email from Heidi in Berkeley, California, who asks, where did the Star Bar go? I remember it from the 70s, and it was a sort of a peanut butter crunch jobber. It disappeared from California, but I remember finding it again on a family trip when I was 12. I bought it and ate the whole box and probably became ill, and I'll never forget this bar. But anyway, the point, it was a good email, Star Bar good.
Yes.
You know what happened to that?
It, again, like all these other bars we talked about, the one that leaps to mind for me is the Scrunch Bar. It was a popular bar for a while, and then it was either discontinued because it didn't make money or the company was bought out. There used to be 6,000 confectionery companies in this country, and there are really just several hundred now. The story of candy is really the story of almost every other American industry. It's tremendous consolidation. The many become the few. And in the process, you want to really, if you're the big guys, you want to reinforce your brand. So you don't want the Star Bar or the Marathon or the Caravelle or the Chocolite around to distract people from the Snickers, the M&M's, the Hershey bar.
Oh, great. So here we are back to globalization.
Unfortunately,
yes,
you think
every
it's this
topic,
innocent.
It comes back to globalization. Anyway, we have another email from Wayne Gislin in Long Lake, Minnesota, who writes, Valo Milk, a great candy that I loved when growing up in the 50s and 60s. Where did that go? Well, I guess we know where it went, or maybe it didn't. Do you know about Valo Milk?
Not only do I know about a Valo Milk, but I am looking at a Valo Milk right this moment.
No way.
Valo Milk is a, yes way, it's an absolutely delicious candy bar. It's a Kansas City candy bar made by the Cyphers company, and actually it's a great sort of success story. The Cyphers was a candy concern in Kansas City. They made a whole bunch of different brands, and then they sort of were bought out, and that company decided to discontinue the Valo Milk, and Russ Cyphers, who was the grandson of the founder, decided that he wanted to start it up again, but he didn't really have equipment, so he dug the old equipment that his grandfather used to use out of the basement and started up a company that remade the Valo Milks. This is a delicious candy cup, just like a Reese's peanut butter cup, with an exquisite chocolate and a really delicious vanilla syrup. Now, I was very skeptical because I thought, ugh, it's too close to marshmallow and I'm not a big marshmallow fan, but this is really high-grade stuff, and you can still find them actually in Cracker Barrel. They're nationally distributed. The one thing about the Valo Milk that makes it difficult is it's a very messy bar. The tagline used to be, if it gets on your chin, you know it's a Valo Milk. And they also can't be transported by plane because they're so delicate that they explode.
Okay, there's one aspect of this story we haven't gotten to, and I'm hoping Edward in Salem, Oregon will take us there. Go ahead, you're on the air.
My name's Ed, and I'm a chocoholic, I guess. I used to be, my first exercise in economic freedom was to buy the Sir candy bar, which I haven't seen around for a long time. But at any rate, I have a dentist perspective on this because I deal with it all the time. Because little kids, as soon as they have their first money, want to buy a candy bar. And, you know, my contention is that it's not so much the candies that are causing the problem, unless they're hard candies that stay in the mouth for a really long time. Things like chocolate that can be eaten down quickly don't really cause problems. But we're seeing a lot more kids strung out on juice and soda pop, and that causes big problems.
Okay, Edward, thanks very much for the call.
You bet.
We'll have one other that I have to mention, and that's Shula, actually, from Edmond, Oklahoma, mentions this, Bonomo, because I remember the jingle, B-O-N-O-M-O-O-O-O, it's Bonomo, Turkish taffy. Gone, right?
No, actually, the Bonomo Turkish taffy is you can still find it, and thousands of people are Bonomo fanatics like yourself. I was very heartened to hear the dentist say that chocolate isn't the great evil in the sweets world.
Okay, we've got to run. Thanks, Steve. Steve Allman is the author of Candy Freak, A Journey Through the Chocolate Underbelly of America. He joined us from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. In Washington, I'm Joe Palca, NPR News.